Thank you. Good morning, everybody, and it's lovely to be with you this morning. Today, you draw to the close of your series from the book of Nehemiah. Children's fairy stories tell us that good people who survive specific evil attacks live happily ever after. But real life, the life of real relationships, real marriages, real jobs, real business dealings, doesn't match up to fairy stories. Neither does church life. Within the church, some complain that things never change, but in reality, the opposite is often true, because things never stay the same. And as you look at this chapter of Nehemiah, you'll see that things haven't stayed the same. Last time, if you remember, the Israelites were celebrating together and dedicating the wall and themselves to God. They were serious about God, about hearing from him, and God met with them in a very special way. Following this time, Nehemiah had governed them for a period of about 12 years. And then he'd returned to his post serving King Artaxerxes. But when he returned to Jerusalem at his own request for a further spell as governor, he found that things had changed. The temple had been desecrated, tithes had dried up, business had got in the way of them observing the Sabbath, and mixed marriages had established themselves once more. And so now we read of Nehemiah taking action to get things in shape all over again. It had been perhaps about 20 years since the original commitments had been made. And the community had had plenty of time to drift away from the sense it once had of their importance. The memory of the mountaintop experience of the spiritual high was no longer vivid. And their passion for God's praise and glory was no longer a driving force. For Nehemiah, it was like they'd gone back to square one. And he was angry because his high hopes of Israel's faithfulness had been squashed. The Israelites, you remember, had experienced God's presence in a very real way. But here they are, several years on, completely ignoring the revelations that they'd once had. Many of you may have had moments when you felt similarly very close to God, real spiritual experiences of God's presence with you, perhaps on a retreat that you've been on, or on holiday even, when you've been out in the countryside and you've been on a walk and you've felt God's presence with you. Yet we all know that these experiences don't last. And they're not supposed to. God doesn't want us permanently to live on the mountaintop. The disciples, if you remember, had to leave the Mount of Transfiguration after the overwhelming experience of seeing Jesus glorified and talking with Moses and Elijah. And they had to return with Jesus to the ordinary world at ground level. Parents don't give their children endless sweets as they know it won't be good for them. And similarly, God doesn't give us spiritual highs all the time. If he did, we wouldn't grow in Christian maturity. But that doesn't mean that we should forget him and return to our old ways as if we didn't know him at all. But this is what the Israelites had done. They'd drifted further and further away from God since their profound meeting with him in 444 BC. New Testament writers regularly speak of the world in a human and cultural sense. They speak of the world as trying to squeeze Christians into its mold, a mold which is apart from God and against God. And Israel's lapses illustrate this. The world's values had taken over their lives again. They'd forgotten God, and they'd forgotten their promises to him. And so Nehemiah steps in, and he disciplines them. And chapter 13, if you read the whole of chapter 13, it shows us Nehemiah practicing a rather negative side of discipline. He throws Tobiah's furniture out of the temple. He rebukes the officials, the nobles, and the heads of families for what they'd allowed. And in one instance, when you read this chapter, he actually comes to blows with the offenders and pulls out their hair. All very dramatic. He threatens the Sabbath traders. He drives away the priests who were Sanballat's son-in-law. And you remember Sanballat was one of Nehemiah's opponents. And then he purifies the temple, the Levites, and the priests. And whilst when we're reading it, we might not approve of the way Nehemiah went about all of this, his concern was to promote right thinking and right living among the Israelites. He knew that discipline was necessary in order for Jerusalem to bring glory to God once more. He was looking towards the future. He wanted to ensure that the temple would never fail again, and that the rest of this binding agreement that was made 20 years earlier would be observed as well. His motives were good, even if he comes across as rather angry and judgmental. Nehemiah had a deep outrage because he longed for God's glory and he hated all that obscured and obstructed it. He was angry because Jerusalem's faithfulness had failed. Worldliness had invaded and spiritual ruin was in progress. And you might have noticed that punctuating the narrative at various points, we have Nehemiah's brief prayers, very short prayers. And these prayers reflect who he is and the situation that he's found himself in. He is a man at this point under intense pressure. But he's still walking in a moment-by-moment awareness of God. How do you react under pressure? Do you turn to God? Or do you crumble under the pressure first before remembering then to turn to God? Sometimes what I do. Nehemiah prays under pressure. He's also a man who doesn't seek the approval of others, of those around him, but he seeks God's approval. He was desperately disappointed by what he had found, and he wanted to build up again what had been broken. He wasn't pleading for blessings on the basis of his achievements before God. He knew that God's favor only comes by grace and mercy. He was simply asking God to remember him and what he had done. Nehemiah could have built a monument to himself. He could have written this, you remember the wall that's been built around Jerusalem. He could have written a big inscription on the wall that said, "Built by Nehemiah the Great." He could have looked back at his life and been proud of all his accomplishments. Or he could have been very frustrated because the believers had broken their promises. In other words, he could have been impressed with his past accomplishments, or discouraged about the present situation. But he chose neither of those things. He simply says to God, "Lord, a day is coming when all of this will be over. I want the meaning of my life to be anchored in the future." He knew that there was a time coming when he would be rewarded by the Lord and embraced by him. And his prayers revealed that he was living for that day when the Lord would say to him, "Well done, good and faithful servant." In the New Testament, we have a story of Jesus with a woman who honors him by pouring an entire jar of precious ointment over Jesus, holding none of it back. And Jesus says to this woman and to the disciples, "She did what she could. She has done a beautiful thing for me." Nehemiah's like that. He did what he could. He used his brains, he used his creativity, his strength of mind and body. He used his position and his privilege in society, his wisdom and his wealth in order to honour God, to build up God's people and advance God's praise in Jerusalem. Studies of Nehemiah have profiled him as a great example of leadership, and that's not wrong. But I also see him as an example of persevering faithfulness to God. He stands out as one of God's friends. We can almost hear his heart of faith beating as he tells us of the tasks that he's done, the obstacles that he surmounted, and the way he refused to be discouraged when he had, in effect, to go back to the beginning and start all over again with the Israelites. And maybe one of the most important things that we can learn from Nehemiah is simply to do what we can for God, for God's cause and his church, and so fulfill our calling as his disciples, as people whom Jesus calls his friends. If we live under grace, we should overflow with gratitude, and that gratitude should show itself with acts of loyalty and love. Our ambition should be to receive God's well done, good and faithful servant. You've done what you could. You've done a beautiful thing. Wouldn't that be great at the end of our lives to hear those words? A story. Clarence Jordan was a man of unusual abilities and commitment. He had two PhDs, one in agriculture and one in Greek and Hebrew. He was so gifted, he could have chosen to do anything he wanted, yet he chose to serve the poor. In the 1940s, he founded a farm in Georgia and called it Koinonia Farm. It was a community for poor whites and poor blacks. And as you might guess, such an idea didn't go down well in the deep south of the 1940s. Ironically, much of the resistance came from church people who followed the laws of segregation as much as the other folk in town. And the town people tried everything they could do to stop Clarence. They tried boycotting him and slashing workers' tyres when they came to town. And over again, for 14 years, they tried to stop him. And finally, in 1954, the Ku Klux Klan had enough of Clarence Jordan, and they decided to get rid of him for once and all. They came one night with guns and torches and set fire to every building on Koinonia Farm, except Clarence's home, which they riddled with bullets. And they chased off all the families except one black family, which refused to leave. Clarence recognised the voices of many of the Klansmen, and as you might guess, some of them were church members. Another was the local newspaper reporter. And the next day, the reporter came to see what remained of the farm. And the rubble was still smouldering from the fire, and the land was scorched. But he found Clarence in the field, hoeing and planting. "I heard the awful news," he called to Clarence, "and I came out to do a story on the tragedy of your farm closing." And Clarence just kept on hoeing and planting. The reporter kept prodding and poking, trying to get a reaction from this quietly determined man who seemed to be planting instead of packing his bags. So finally, the reporter said in a haughty voice, "Well, Dr. Jordan, you got two of them PhDs and you put 14 years into this farm and there's nothing left of it at all. Just how successful do you think you've been?" Clarence stopped hoeing, turned towards the reporter with his penetrating blue eyes and said quietly but firmly, "About as successful as the cross. Sir, I don't think you understand. What we are about is not success, but faithfulness. We're staying. Good day." And beginning that day, Clarence and his companions rebuilt Koinonia, and the farm is still there today. I believe God calls us to faithfulness. The Christian writer Eugene Peterson has written a book called A Long Obedience in the Same Direction, the subtitle of which is Discipleship in an Instant Society. And his opening paragraph is a quote from Nietzsche, who wrote, "The essential thing in heaven and earth is that there should be a long obedience in the same direction. There thereby results, and has always resulted in the long run, something which has made life worth living. A long obedience in the same direction." If we believe we're called to be disciples of Jesus Christ, then like Nehemiah, we're called to faithfulness, whatever our circumstances. Occasionally, God may bless us with mountaintop spiritual experiences, times when we know beyond all shadow of a doubt that God is there and that he loves us. But times like those won't last forever. And in the in-between times, which is most of the time, we're called to simply follow Jesus. Our cultural context is very different from the days of Nehemiah. But I believe we're still called to live distinctive lives, lives that shine out in society. We maybe haven't made the same vows that they made about the Sabbath, about mixed marriages or tithing, but many of us have committed ourselves to discipleship. And that means that we're committed to following Jesus' ways. At varying times in our individual lives and in our church life, this will take on different emphases and different shapes. But we must never allow things to drift so far that we lose sight of our calling. You've seen Nehemiah to be a man who was passionate for God. He was a man of prayer, a man steeped in God's laws, a man of compassion and concern for his people, but above all, a man who didn't give up. Let's take our calling seriously too. And I pray that like Nehemiah, you will know the joy of the Lord to be your strength and your sustainer as you continue your walk with him. Amen.